cold metal of the gun against his skin is almost comforting to him. As long as he has his gun, everything is okay with the world. He sits unseen in the shrubbery. It won't be long until someone passes by. Then he'll follow them for a while, the feelings building, until he's ready. Then the gun will be raised, and his fantasy will be back in action. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 175, The Serial Crimes of Vilapi Ndlovukamandla. This episode is sponsored by Krypton Signs. You probably don't know this about me, but in my previous life, like pre-podcast, not pre-birth, I worked at a signage company for 12 years. Yeah, I'm one of those lifer employees. I still have a really soft spot for the signage industry, which I know sounds weird, but there's something about helping people to create one of the most important parts of branding for their business that feels like you're making a real difference. So when Krypton Signs wanted to come on board as a sponsor for the podcast, I thought that was a really cool full circle moment. If you're looking to make a bold statement with your business, Krypton Signs will bring your brand to life with custom signage that stands out. Whether you need eye-catching storefront signs, event banners, or vehicle wraps, they've got you covered. No job is too big or too small, and they deliver top quality results fast. Krypton Signs offers free consultations to help you design the perfect sign for your business. If you're ready to make your business impossible to ignore, visit the lovely folks over at Krypton Signs at www.kryptonsigns.co.za or call 069-409-7112 today for a free quote. That's Krypton Signs. Your signage, your way. Call 069-409-7112 now and get started. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Eugene Peterser, Natalie Dupp, Monique Engelbrecht, Monique Rousseau, Michelle, Graham Lodge, Katlego Mogapi, Laura Burgess, Linny V, Gareth Mathieu, and Kaylee Killen for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. I think sometimes when I cover serial murder cases, because we have a pretty good investigative service for serial murder crimes, it might be easy to get the impression that once a series is identified, the investigation thereafter is pretty smooth and will lead to the identification of the killer relatively quickly. And while South Africa does rank as one of the fastest countries in the world at arresting and convicting serial murderers from the point of the series being identified, the path to that conviction is very often littered with a ton of investigative debris behind the scenes. In researching this case, I used two books by Dr. Mickey Pistorius, Catch Me a Killer and Strangers on the Street. You may also recognize this case from the Catch Me a Killer series on Showmax. I also used a few excerpts from academic studies around themes raised in this case and a few internet sites for information on the area the case occurred in, as well as its history. So let's get into episode 175, The Serial Crimes of Velapi Ndlangamandla.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
I've said this before and I'll say it again. I really do love how my research for this podcast always has me discovering new things about South Africa and its history. This time, it was the history of a South African town in the Mpumalanga province called Mkondo, and the man after whom it was originally named, Piet Retief. Of course, I learned about the man in history in school, but as I've said before, I'm constantly amazed at the version of South African history that was taught when I was in high school, and how one-sided it was. I'm sure that's different now, at least I hope so. But when I was matriculating in 1998, actually around the same time this case takes place, either we weren't taught the underlayer of the dates and names and places and random facts, or maybe at 17 or 18 I simply wasn't mature enough to think about things more critically. Either way, I love that I'm learning this now, and it puts a whole lot more into context. Of course, I have to measure up what I include, otherwise we'll end up with a history podcast rather than a true crime podcast. But I do think that it's important to understand at least a little bit about the towns crimes occur in, because the location of crime often becomes a character in the case that helps to form the perpetrators and the victims. In 1835, a Dutch settler called Piet Retief would begin a movement, eventually referred to as the Great Trek, or Die Groot Trek in Afrikaans. Retief and his fellow Dutch settlers began moving up north into the interior of South Africa. The reason for the move was, officially, that the settlers had heard of wonderfully fertile land in the interior and they wanted to access new grazing land for their animals. But there was also another reason for the move. Around this time, British colonial forces had taken over the Cape and what was then called Natal, now KwaZulu-Natal. The British had decided that slavery would be abolished and enslaved people were freed by law. To be very clear, although this sounds like a wonderful moment of human decency, it was not all that. And so-called freedom for the enslaved Black and Khoisan people of South Africa under British colonial rule was only marginally better than what they'd previously endured. The Dutch settlers, by and large, were unhappy with this decision, as they felt that they should be compensated for the human beings they had purchased as slaves. Many of the other laws that the British colonists imposed were also not gelling with the Dutch settlers, and so they began their trek to the interior. One of the men leading this move was Piet Retief. They would eventually end up in a few different provinces, but he specifically ended up in the province now known as Mpumalanga, where he allegedly bartered for a piece of land of 12,820 hectares with the king of Swaziland at the time, King Mswati II. This piece of land would become a town, first called Piet-Retief and now called Mkondo. Interestingly, until about 20 years ago, some residents of the Kingdom of Swaziland, now called Eswatini, were campaigning to have this and other surrounding tracts of land returned to the people of Eswatini, as some did not recognize the alleged historical agreement between Retief and King Mswati II. More recently, it's been alleged that this claim is no longer being pushed, as King Mswati III, the current king of Eswatini, has acknowledged that there was some form of barter between the individuals which had resulted in the exchange of land. And although I went way deeper into that rabbit hole with some interesting bits of information surfacing, I'll stop there on the history bit. Present-day Mkondo is a timber-growing region of the province. Its main economic activities are timber, paper, and wattle bark production, as well as the mining of mica, kaolin, and iron. Like many South African towns created during the colonial or other settler rule, as well as during apartheid, when the Group Areas Act forced the segregation of people into areas by race, the area in which most black residents of Mkondo lived was located on the outskirts of what was considered the borders of the town itself, at least in 1997 when this case occurred. Itanda Kukanya was considered the formal settlement in which most black residents of the town lived, and just behind that is a more informal area called Poswa Village, which covers a radius of about 10 kilometres. It would be in this area where in 1997 a serial predator began to hunt. The crime which started off this series was also the crime which actually enabled the series to happen at all. The serial killer is quite different in his modus operandi from some other South African serial killers, because most local serial offenders of this nature do not use guns. Around this time, and even now to an extent, it's relatively difficult for ordinary individuals to get their hands on guns, legally or illegally. And even if you can get a firearm, ammunition is expensive on the black markets and not always readily available. The illegal side does become slightly easier if you're involved with gangs or housebreakings, as would become the case here. But there's often little crossover between the two, and most serial killers tend to prefer more hands-on methods. This killer, though, would get a very particular psychological benefit from using a gun. On the 4th of April 1997, a home was broken into near Mkondo. Jewelry, clothing, cash, and food were stolen, but the two most important and dangerous items taken in the robbery was the resident's .22 caliber rifle and a box of ammunition. The rifle's nickname was the Saloon, and it would be that name that would become the serial killer's moniker. He used it to kill his first victim just 20 days later. On the 24th of April 1997, a shop was robbed near Mkondo. Two security guards living on the premises were attacked by the perpetrator. One man, Shaka Dlamini, was shot and killed. When Shaka's autopsy was done, it was found that he'd been shot by a .22 caliber rifle. 2 months later, on the 13th of June 1997, two men and a woman were attacked on a road 2 kilometres from Poswa village. The seemingly random attack saw the woman sustaining a .22 caliber gunshot wound to the arm, one of the men being shot in the back, and a second man, Sitenda Dlamini, sustaining a gunshot wound to the head, which ended his life immediately. The other two victims thankfully survived. Later that evening, at the local tavern owned and run by Konzapi Ngwabi, a group of friends sat discussing the terrifying shooting that had occurred earlier in the day. The tavern was run from Konzapi's house. One of the rooms housed customers and while her staff and her daughter served them, Konzapi sat in the kitchen of her house, chatting with her friend, Aaron Mchali. As they discussed how strange the sudden and unexplained shooting was, Konzapi's daughter, Thandazile, popped her head in to say that she was tired and going to bed. Her mother wished her good nights, just as another friend of hers, Mandla Ngwenya, joined them in the kitchen. Mandla hadn't even been in the kitchen for a few minutes when two men entered the tavern entrance. One was dressed in an army coat and wore a black balaclava. Without any warning, the balaclava-wearing man raised a rifle and shot Mandla in the stomach and then shot Aaron in the head. Chaos erupted, with customers screaming and trying to get out of the door or take cover. Konzapi screamed at the man, asking him what he was doing. He gave no response, except to point his rifle in her direction and fire a shot at her head. All three victims died within a very short period of sustaining their injuries. But the horror in the tavern was not over. Hearing the gunshots, young Thandazile woke up and stumbled into the kitchen. There she saw the two men and the bodies on the floor of the three people who just shortly before had been bidding her a good night, including her mother. The girl froze as the previously masked man removed his balaclava and told his accomplice he just found someone else he wanted to kill. His accomplice walked over to Thandazile, grabbed her arm and guided her outside. The young girl stood outside in the cold for a few minutes, but she was dazed, not understanding what her eyes were seeing, certain that this was all just a nightmare, and if she could just get back to her bed, she could go back to sleep, and she would surely wake to find that this had all just been a horrible dream. Thandazile stumbled back inside, only to find that the nightmare had increased in proportion in the last few minutes. The young girl witnessed the two men raping her dead mother's body. In shock, she made her way around the back of the property and into a bedroom. She pushed herself underneath one of the beds and eventually fell into a fitful sleep there. A neighbor would find her still hiding there the next morning, when the scene of carnage was discovered. All of the cases I've mentioned so far would land on the desk of Captain Darnie Hall of Secunda Murder and Robbery Unit. Hall already suspected that he may have a serial offender on his hands. The close spacing of the murders, as well as the commonality of the caliber of weapon used. The saloon rifle was not a terribly common weapon either, and one had been reported stolen in a recent robbery. The pieces all fit together, and when Hall received the docket for the most recent crime, he quickly jumped on interviewing the multiple witnesses. One of the men involved in the murders and rape at the tavern was identified by the patrons of Konzapi's tavern. Vusi Khumalo was arrested the following day, and Captain Hall thought he'd either arrested the killer, or at the very least, the killer's accomplice. Khumalo denied having been involved in any other crimes and claimed he didn't know the identity of the man who'd fired the shots. He said he'd been intoxicated and hadn't known that anyone was going to get hurt that night, but he'd gone with the man when he'd asked him to accompany him. Hall didn't believe a word he was saying, and upon interviewing Vusi's brother, he said that Vusi hung around with a man called Lucky quite often. The brother didn't have a surname for Lucky, though. Vusi denied knowing anyone called Lucky, but despite his denials, he was arrested for the post-mortem rape of Konzapi Ngwabi and detained. The murders continued while Vusi Khumalo was in jail, though, and so Hall realized that the man was not his killer, and he had no way to prove that he hadn't really just been intoxicated and followed the actual killer into the tavern that night, and perhaps didn't know his identity. Just 5 days after the Tavern Massacre, Amelia Mbenyane was sleeping in her home in Porsoa village when a man broke down her door and shot her in the head, killing her instantly. More than a month later, on the 28th of July 1997, Dingindayo Twala was walking on a road near Porsoa village when he was shot and killed with a .22-caliber weapon. Although Captain Donnie Hall had already been tasked with investigating all of the murders this killer had committed thus far, his location in Secunda, 2.5 hours from Mkondo, meant that this murder did not come to his attention immediately, and it would only join his growing docket of the man dubbed the Saloon Killer much later on. In the meantime, another break-in was committed in Porsoa. Although the intruder fired at the homeowner and the caliber matched the saloon, the victim was not hit and escaped relatively unharmed. Lucky Mbuli would not escape unharmed, though. On the 5th of September, when he and his girlfriend were awoken from sleep in their home in the village, Lucky heard someone rattling the window, attempting to break in, and he went outside to see what was going on. He spotted an intruder and chased the man to a nearby river, but the man turned in his tracks and shot Lucky in the chest. Lucky began stumbling back to his home, but the gunman followed and shot him again. He died on his doorstep, his killer fleeing into the night. 20 days later, Yvonne Kambule was washing dinner dishes in her home in Porsoa. She, her boyfriend, his friend and her sister had just finished eating. Yvonne opened the front door to throw out the dishwater, and she'd just taken a few steps outside when those inside the home heard a loud sound they initially thought was someone playing cricket, a ball hitting a bat. But the horrific truth was revealed just minutes later when Yvonne staggered back inside, blood pouring from a .22-caliber gunshot to her breast. She passed away before help could arrive. That very same night, just 1.5 hours after Yvonne took her last breath, two men were getting out of a taxi on a road near Porsoa. A man began walking behind them and suddenly shouted at them to hand over their possessions. The men were confused and froze momentarily until they saw the rifle and heard the gunfire and a bullet whizzing past them through the air. The men began throwing stones at the shooter, hoping to get him to leave them alone, but he just raised his rifle and continued shooting. The men were hit by this lobby of bullets in the hand and the stomach, but they managed to escape and recovered from their injuries. A full month after these attacks, Bongani Mlipa was walking on a plantation near Porsoa with his friend, Petrus Maduma. They were returning home from a visit to a nearby tavern when a man appeared from behind the trees and without a word began shooting at them. Bongani was struck in the head and died almost immediately. Petrus managed to escape but dropped a few items of clothing he'd been carrying at the scene. When Bongani's body was found the next morning, the clothing was collected as evidence. Petrus did not come forward himself. He'd been intoxicated at the time and was terrified, not knowing who it was that had shot at them. It's important to keep in mind that, as I've mentioned in other serial cases where the killer targeted black South Africans, at this time in our country's history, just 3 years after apartheid had officially fallen and democracy had dawned, the vast majority of black, coloured and Indian descent South Africans were still coming to terms with the fact that the South African police service was now supposed to be just that, a service, and not a force to be used against them as it had been before. Deep and completely understandable mistrust still lingered, and Petrus had no idea who had attacked him and his friend that night. Rifles like the one the man had were uncommon in Porsoa, so the killer could have been anyone, as far as Petrus was concerned, with any sort of connections. He could have no way of knowing that going to the police would actually be safe for him, so he didn't. But Captain Hall did track the terrified man down through the clothing he'd left behind. And when he approached Petrus, a can of incredibly confused worms would be opened that, although not bringing this case any further along the line, did perfectly display how people can be so intimidated by police that they will say anything to end the interaction. Through questioning Petrus, Hall was led to a man named Lala. Lala at first said he didn't know anything about the shooting, but after some questioning, he implicated another man. This man was also brought in for questioning, and he would eventually confess to having shot Bongani, and said Lala had given him the weapon to do so. The man also implicated several others in the shooting. The web of finger-pointing eventually became so tangled that Captain Hall took a step back and considered what might be happening. He started checking where these men actually were on the night that Bongani was killed and realized that not one of them had actually been involved, and none of them even knew what type of weapon had been used. They were all just saying what they thought Hall wanted to hear to get out of the situation. Petrus had mentioned, though, that he and Bongani had passed a tuck shop when they alighted the taxi and they'd seen someone there they knew by the name Lucky. This Lucky was the only man he'd seen until the shooter had approached them, so perhaps it could have been him. Although Hall was not getting an exact identity for this Lucky, the name did seem to be popping up over and again in his investigation, so he could not discount that it may be linked to the killer. Shortly after Bongani's murder, an anonymous phone call came in to the police station reporting a body on the road near Poswa. The victim was Amos Nkosi. He'd been shot and robbed of his belongings. The anonymous call was very likely not from the killer, but rather from a frightened resident who had discovered Amos's body and simply, once again, unsure of who they could trust. After the discovery of Amos's body, the murders stopped for 3 months. Now, I've seen this happen in other murder series too, especially those occurring in more rural areas and around this period of time in history. It's not entirely uncommon, it seems, for some of these serial murderers to take a break around the festive season. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it is a pattern I've noticed. Many South Africans have no choice but to travel to other provinces to find work and often leave their families behind, and the festive season is a time when many will travel back home and be able to spend time with their families. I have to wonder whether this has something to do with this trend. By the time January 1998 rolled around, though, the SAPS was no closer to catching their killer, and he was getting ready to strike again. Although the killer would later detail an element of sexual fantasy around these crimes, except for the rape of Konzabi Ngwabi right in the beginning of this series, the killer had not sexually assaulted any of his female victims. That changed, though, on the 5th of January 1998, when Maria Kumalo was found raped and murdered in a cornfield near Mkondo. 10 days later, a shop in Poswa village was broken into, and the security guard, Ambrose Ntalentoli, was shot and killed. Before the month concluded, the killer struck yet again, and Absalom Nkosi was shot and killed while riding his bicycle. His bicycle was stolen. On the 5th of February, the killer struck again. Thankfully, this time, his victim, Michael Shongwe, survived. That same night, though, he broke into a home in Poswa village while the residents, Tokozile Mkwananzi and Nelly Mdili, were sleeping. Nelly was shot in the head and died immediately. She was 8 months pregnant when she was murdered. As the murders continued, Another pattern was starting to reveal itself in the shooter's marksmanship. Almost all of the head wounds were in exactly the same location, 2 centimeters above the left eyebrow. Considering most of the scenes were chaotic and the victims were not necessarily standing still or restrained when they were shot, the precise shooting told Captain Hall and later profiler Mickey Pistorius that the killer must have had some kind of weapons training. This opened up the possibility that he was either a current or ex-police officer, or he had been or was currently in the army, or in one of the militant groups that had formed as apartheid resistance. It would not be easy, if even possible, for an ordinary citizen to become this highly trained with a firearm without some sort of involvement in an armed career. Just 2 days after Nelly's murder, Fani Malinga and his female friend were walking near Poswa. The killer appeared seemingly out of nowhere and shot and killed Fani. The woman managed to escape. A month later, Rebecca Manana was found dead on a road near Poswa. She'd been shot in the head. After this, the killer seemed to shift environments slightly. With all the murders, there was increased police activity around Poswa village, and it's very possible that this was one of the reasons he decided to change locations. From this point, he would begin killing victims who live on the farms and plantations that surrounded Poswa village. With farm workers often living on the farms in supplied accommodation, it was almost too easy for him. On the 9th of March, he entered the home of Babili Nduba. He shot the man in the chest, and Babili passed away shortly after. The killer stole the food the man had been preparing for himself for dinner. That same night, just an hour later, he entered another home, but thankfully the resident was able to hide and was not injured. Then he moved to a farm next door, killing a dog guarding the home of one of the residents. At the next home on the farm, he kicked the door open and began to assault Leonard Hadebe. Leonard's grandmother was sleeping on the bed, and when she heard the ruckus, she woke up and, very probably without even thinking, charged at the man with the rifle. She was so angry at his presence and so worked up that she seemed to scare the killer, and he didn't even raise his rifle in her direction before fleeing into the night. On Saturday the 4th of April, residents of a farm called Hudutro, just outside Nkondo, called police to report a man running around the farm threatening people with a rifle. The killer was becoming more and more brazen. At 1:30 that afternoon, he attacked and attempted to rape one of the residents of the farm. At 6 p.m., he threatened another man with his weapon. At 7 p.m., he shot and killed Elphus Mbuli. His bloodlust, seemingly sated for that moment, he slinked off and left the residents in shock. The wave of violence and fear was now a tsunami, and finally authorities agreed to what Captain Hall had been asking for all along: a formal, dedicated task team to capture this killer. Hall had watched almost helplessly from Secunda as more and more murders were reported, and he desperately scrambled from scene to scene trying to gather statements, work informant tips, and note down descriptions from survivors, all with a 2.5-hour drive either way from his office. It was simply an impossible task for one person, and the killer was taking full advantage. Hall knew that there was a good chance that a task team being formed would mean he would lose the case, but he didn't care about that. The people of Poswa village were being hunted, and the saloon killer had to be brought to justice before he killed again. In May 1998, a task team was finally formed under Superintendent Koos Faree. Detectives from all surrounding jurisdictions were invited to join to ensure that they had all their bases covered. Profiler Mickey Pistorius was asked to come in from Johannesburg to assist in creating a profile of the offender, which would aid detectives in channeling their investigation. The operations room was set up at Mkhondo SAPS office. All of the cases believed to be part of the Saloon Killer series were gathered together, and when Mickey Pistorius arrived, she went through each docket. The team then visited each of the scenes together as well. They didn't want to alert the killer to their now targeted investigation, so they didn't get out of their cars in Poswa village and just got a feel for where the homes of the victims were and which roads pedestrians had been targeted on. They did get out of their cars on the farms, though. And in her book, Catch Me a Killer, Mickey Pistorius recalls walking into the now abandoned home of Babili Nduba. His mattress still lay in the corner with his personal effects beside it. The cooking pots he'd been using still stood in the fire. Its contents stolen by the killer, just as he'd stolen Babili's life. As new resources were brought in to help the team, a forensic artist began to meet with the surviving victims to draw up a sketch of what the killer looked like. After reviewing all the files, Mickey was able to put together a profile of their killer. From what she'd seen of his crimes, Pistorius believed that the killer had likely been rejected by one or both of his parents when he was a child. This may have created a deep sense of distrust or paranoia toward people in general. She believed that as a child he may have had a secret hiding place that he'd gone to where he could be the hero in his own story and take back his power. She was relatively certain that he was a current or ex-soldier and that his firearm provided him with a sense of power and control and would essentially be an extension of him. Given the series of violent murders he'd committed, Pistorius considered that the man may have been discharged from the army and as a result held a grudge against humanity in general. If he could not be a soldier, he would bring the war to the people of Poswa village, except only he would be armed. One of the most important members of the task team was one Sergeant Tela. He was one of the few members of the local SAPS who knew Poswa village like the back of his hand, and he had roots there. The residents trusted him, which was incredibly rare. Sergeant Tela had early on set upon his network of informants, trying to get information about anyone bragging about the crimes or anyone being in the possession of a Saloon rifle. He received information about two brothers living together in Poswa who had weapons. No one knew their real names or what types of guns they owned, but it was certainly an interesting lead, and the police wanted to put surveillance on the house. Due to the setup of the village, though, this would have been impossible to do with police officers, even if they were in plain clothes. They would stand out like sore thumbs. So instead, the SAPS called up the South African National Defence Force and asked if they had any trained soldiers they could use for this purpose. The army agreed, and while this was being arranged, the task team continued to find other ways they could surveil the residents of the identified home, including taking aerial photographs of the house and its surroundings. An SAPS helicopter was eventually procured to carry out the task, but the photographer ended up taking incredibly blurry and rather useless photographs. Management wouldn't let the team repeat the exercise for cost reasons, so they were on their own. One of the task team members called in a favour from a friend who worked for a local forestry company, and he was able to get on a flight on one of their helicopters to take proper photographs. Sergeant Taylor had also visited the local prison and interviewed offenders whose recent housebreaking and burglary cases had involved the theft of a .22-caliber rifle. Of course, at this point, police were not yet absolutely certain which robbery had yielded the serial killer's weapon. Taylor was able to discover that a .22 had been given as compensation to a gang member who'd been accidentally shot by another gang member. The man who allegedly received the gun was called Dumasani. He'd never been charged with anything, and he was out on the streets, so he certainly fit as a possible suspect. During these prison interviews, the name Lucky came up again as well, and Tela finally got a surname. Lucky Masibuko was apparently the brother of Dumisani, and these were the two brothers who lived in the house informants had pointed out. Now, with the knowledge that their persons of interest definitely had a .22 among their weapons, it was even more vital to put surveillance on their home. The killer hadn't killed again since the task team had been set up, but every minute that went by put another resident of Porsua village at risk. And in July 1998, the threats became very real again, when Mboyisi Zwane was shot and killed. And then, just 2 days later, the body of Musi Mavuso was found near a dam at Porsua. Both had the signature shot 2 centimeters above their left eyebrow. The SANDF supplied 3 highly trained soldiers for the surveillance. If Mickey Pistorius was correct and the killer was indeed a soldier himself or had been in the past, it seemed ironic that more soldiers would now be deployed to support his capture. Moving the men into the area without a fuss was actually assisted by a totally coincidental occurrence where several people had started setting up illegal structures on a piece of private land next to Porsua village. The structures were being removed, and as a result, there were plenty of new faces in the area, so the 3 soldiers were able to blend right in and erected structures near the targeted house, pretending to be some of the individuals who'd been removed from the private land. From Pistorius's profile, they knew that their killer was highly paranoid, and he would question everything. The last thing they wanted to do was alert him to their presence. As the soldiers took their positions and began the surveillance, the SAPS task team continued to work other leads. They picked up Vusi again, who'd been with the killer at the tavern scene. He still said he didn't know who the man was and hadn't seen him again since that night. In addition, another man in the village was pointed out by one of the survivors as looking similar to the killer. He was arrested, but didn't seem to be a good fit as their suspect. The task team were pretty sure the victim was mistaken, but the survivor was insistent, so they charged the man with only that victim's crime and did not oppose his bail. The charges against this individual would eventually be dropped due to lack of evidence. It was just another sideline in a complex and ever more pressing investigation. On the 21st of August, the killer approached Neliswe Mkonza and her daughter on the street. He killed Neliswe and injured her daughter. With the soldiers' assistance, police were eventually able to get a photograph of Lucky Masibuko, and they arrested him away from the house so as not to alert his brother just yet. When Lucky was brought in, though, the team was once again a little disappointed. The killer had been described as a tall man. Lucky was not tall. Once his house was raided, they did find a .22, but ballistic tests would take some time. They did not find any army coats or balaclavas on the premises. Not wanting to waste the opportunity, though, they arranged for Kunzapi Ngwabi's daughter, Tandazile, who'd witnessed so much of the horror on the night of her mother's death, to attend an identity parade. The young girl had had to move to Vryheid after her mother's murder, as she had no other family in Mkondo, so Lucky Masibuko was transferred to Vryheid for the lineup. And Tandazile pointed him out. She positively identified Lucky. But when the officers began asking some clarifying questions, they realized that they hadn't sufficiently explained the task to the young girl, and she essentially thought that she had to point out anyone she recognized from anywhere. And she did recognize Lucky because he'd been a customer at her mother's tavern. when the officers clarified to Thandazile that they wanted to know if the man who she'd seen raping her mother was in the lineup, the young girl shook her head. No, none of these men were that man. Another sideline inquiry, another dead end. The clock was still ticking. On the 28th of August, the killer's youngest and thankfully final victim was found dead. 15-year-old Mduduzi Vundla had been riding his bicycle near his home when he was shot and killed. His bicycle was stolen. Although all of these leads needed to be run down, and it's never smart to just ignore any possibility, so often it's the unexpected twist that leads to the arrest. At 4 a.m. on the 10th of September, Sergeant Taylor got a phone call from one of his informants. There was a man at a tavern in Poswa. He was drunk, and he was saying all sorts of strange things. He said he was the man police were looking for, and he'd been living in the plantation since police had started investigating in Poswa village. He also said that he planned to still kill a few more people before he left to live in Swaziland. Taylor informed the rest of the team, and within minutes they were mobilized. The man, Vilapi Ndlagamandla, was arrested shortly afterwards. It's not uncommon for criminals to be caught as a result of them not being able to keep quiet about their crimes. And who knows if this was the first time the saloon killer had taken someone into his confidence in a drunken chat. Probably not. But it was the first time he picked the wrong person. It didn't take long for Vilapi to confess to what he'd done, and when police went to search his home, they found the saloon. Ballistics would later match it back to the bullets that had killed many of the victims. After he'd provided an initial confession, he was driven to Pretoria to be interviewed by Dr. Mickey Pistorius. The 32-year-old man worked as a security guard. He lived in Poswa village with his girlfriend. He had a previous criminal record as well, including housebreaking and a charge of rape, which was eventually withdrawn. He confirmed that he'd committed the house robbery during which he'd stolen the saloon rifle. It was this, he said, that had given him the courage to start killing. Vilapi had wanted to be a soldier since he was a child. In fact, his desire for this was so well known that his nickname in the community was Soldier. He'd been turned down by the army, though, and this had created a great sense of resentment within him. Despite being turned down, Vilapi had continued to develop his shooting skills whenever he could get his hands on a gun. When he'd stolen the saloon, he'd spent hours practicing with it. Even though he was able to often find work as a security guard, Vilapi had also turned to a life of crime, and he claimed that while he was imprisoned for one of his convictions, he'd been raped and contracted a sexually transmitted infection, which had affected his ability to achieve an erection. He said that this had further enraged him, especially when women laughed at him when he was being intimate with them and he was unable to perform. His anger and resentment had been bubbling up inside him until the year before, when he'd managed to get his hands on a gun. When he held it, he said, he felt like he was finally powerful. When he killed his victims, he claimed to receive a sexual release when he pulled the trigger, something he experienced as even better than an orgasm. The rifle had become an extension of him. As bizarre as Vilapi's account sounds, it's actually quite similar in theory to the psychology behind foreign object insertion in rape cases. Foreign objects are sometimes used by perpetrators simply to cause additional pain and suffering. But very often they're used as a proxy penis when the perpetrator is unable to achieve an erection to rape the victim for whatever reason. This often becomes the signature if it's done in a series of murders or rapes, because it's very uncommon. And I've also read accounts of other serial killers relating to their firearms as weapons of sexual release, even though there is no overt sexual element to the crimes. The trial of Vilapi Ndlagamandla began in September 2000 after he'd undergone a psychiatric assessment and the prosecutor had rounded up all of the multiple witnesses and ballistic tests had come back. As is almost always the case, despite him providing a full confession, he still pled not guilty, and his defence against the multiple charges seemed to simply be, "It wasn't really me. Prove it." And the prosecution did, several times over. On the 18th of September 2000, he was found guilty of 19 counts of murder, 9 counts of attempted murder, 3 counts of housebreaking, 1 count of illegal possession of a firearm, and 1 count of illegal possession of ammunition. 1 count of attempted robbery, 2 counts of housebreaking with aggravated circumstances, 1 count of indecent assault, and 1 count of pointing a firearm. Due to lack of evidence, he was found not guilty of some of the murders, although on a balance of probabilities, it would seem odd that these victims would have been killed in exactly the same way, in the same place, and around the same time as the other victims, and not have been killed by the same person. On the 19th of September 2000, Vilapi Ndlagamandla was sentenced to 20 life sentences, plus 135 years in prison. By now, he would have already become eligible for parole, as he was sentenced prior to 2004. But I would certainly hope that the fact that he was deemed a serial offender in his trial, and he has 20 life sentences, would contribute to him not getting parole, at least not anytime soon. He was 33 years old when he was sentenced, so he is now 58. In 2032, if he is still alive, he will turn 65, and as he would have served more than 15 years of his sentence, he may be eligible to be released on the basis of his age. Although I've spoken at length before about South Africa's world-class prowess in arresting serial killers, and that is still certainly the case, very often when I cover cases from around this time in history, I get the feeling that far more victims died than needed to. Although I know it's easy to preach from a future point and everything is clear in retrospect, I can't help but feel that too many of these victims were let down. I don't necessarily think it's the police's fault. Not entirely, anyway. There's a lot of things that probably play into it. When series like this happen in rural areas, we see a lot of what happens with American serial killers playing out, where there's several jurisdictions, and one is not necessarily talking to another. This has probably improved more recently with us having a more centralized access to various crimes, but we know it does still happen. The other aspect of why I feel like some of these victims were let down is because of what I call the invisible victim factor. The vast majority of these murders would never have even made it past a local newspaper. And it's very likely that the notion of a serial killer was only mentioned publicly right before the killer was arrested. The people of Poswa village were not rich. They were not famous. And we know very well that in every country in the world, including South Africa, the murder of indigenous and marginalized people is not reported on in the same way that more privileged groups are. In some countries, that's a clear distinction along race lines. And in other countries, like India, for instance, that distinction happens more along class lines. People who live in economically challenging conditions are, by some bizarre societal norm, almost expected to be at risk of dying violently. So they don't get the reports, and they don't get the coverage. And in a case like this, where someone within that same community is the predator, that is a fatal problem. I'd like to think that today, South Africans in general are more willing to report the big things like murder and rape than we were 30 years ago, and we're more willing to hold the police accountable for their failings. But there are still impoverished and rural communities like Poswa all over the country. And if the invisible victim line still applies, then how do we know that there isn't a predator like Vilapi Ndlagamandla right now, huddled in the trees, watching his fellow residents go by, just waiting for the right time to strike? Shaka Dlamini, Konzapi Ngwabi, Aaron Machali, Sitende Dlamini, Mandla Ngwenya, Amelia Mbenyani, Dingin Dawo Twala, Lucky Mbuli, Yvonne Nkambule, Bongani Mlipa, Amos Nkosi, Maria Kumalo, Ambrose Ntantoli, Absalom Nkosi, Nelly Mduli, Fani Malinga, Rebecca Manane, Babili Nduba, Alphys Mbuli, Mbuyisi Zwane, Musi Mavuso, Neliswe Mkonza, and Mduduzi Vundla. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.